Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with information now emerging from Human Rights Watch about massacres in a number of Alawite villages in Syria. A veteran CIA operations officer, Robert Baer, who remains in touch with Alawite officers and intelligence officials, joins us to discuss what may explain why the Syrian regime used chemical weapons. And we'll also look into the Thursday New York Times story that the CIA had suspicions that Edward Snowden had tried to access classified computer files in 2009, a report that on Friday the CIA denied but did not refute. Then we will speak with the American University historian Alan Lichtman, the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, to assess whether the continuing shutdown of the government and the looming threat of default can be avoided by negotiations underway in the Senate that Congressman Paul Ryan is trying to scuttle by offering his plan to solve the two fiscal crises the House Republicans have created by removing family planning coverage under Obamacare and delaying its defunding while not giving up on killing it. Then finally, we'll speak with Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, about the real agenda behind Republican efforts to justify their shutdown of the government and threats of default by citing the need to get the budget under control when, in fact, at the end of the day, reducing the deficit, according to Thomas Ferguson, is just a smokescreen for cutting taxes on the wealthy. And joining us now is Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, as well as the former Soviet Union. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian, for having me again.
And let's begin with these stories emerging now from Human Rights Watch, where a number of villages in and around Latakia, the Alawite area of Syria, this happened on the 4th of August, these villages were overrun and the inhabitants, all Alawites, were massacred. 190 civilians were killed, including 57 women, 18 children, and 14 elderly men. And a number of female relatives and children were taken hostage, and their fate still remains uncertain. This is beginning to emerge to indicate that the massacre took place in early August, but the Syrian army, the Assad forces, only recaptured these villages on the 18th of August, and the chemical weapons attack was on the 21st. So the impression that's starting to emerge is that the Alawites were basically furious with the Assads because they didn't protect them, and that the Assads felt the need to use the chemical weapons as a way to up the ante in this kind of tribal tit-for-tat, because they essentially are the guarantors of the Alawites, and they were massacred. So is this beginning to look like the justification for the use of the chemical weapons in this August 21st?
It's not looking like it. It was. What happened was that in these massacres in early August, they were absolutely horrific. And the Alawites were, you know, sexual mutilation of live victims, on and on and on. And the news of this went around the capital immediately among the Alawites, that the Salafis were moving on the Alawite mountain and were going to kill everybody. And they looked at Bashar, and there were pictures of this stuff, and it truly is horrific. They said, you've got to do something about this. And I think there's absolutely a clear nexus between these massacres and the sarin attack on the 21st, a tit-for-tat, if you like. You also have to keep in mind that the Salafis were getting close to the natal village of the Assads, Kerdaha, which is something in their minds they can never give up because that's the end of the community. So, I mean, I just think it's just a pure ignorance on the part of the American media to look at this as, you know, again, it's an Arab evil, you know, dictator doing what he does for pure joy, and it's wrong. We're seeing a sectarian war in this part of the world like we've never seen before. In fact, I can't even imagine since the Mongols.
And some of these groups that are involved in this massacre include the al-Nusra Front, the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant, Jaish al-Muhajirin, and al-Ansar al-Har al-Sham, and Sukkah al-Iz. Now, the Jaish al-Muhajirin, they apparently are dressed in these kind of Pakistani black tunics. So are these guys really coming from that far afield, these jihadis?
They're coming from all over the world, from Pakistan. They're coming from Iraq. They're coming from Western Europe. They are taking on what, you know, the clothes of the Wahhabi, the strictest form of Islam. And, you know, they make no bones about it. They intend to destroy the Alawites and the Christians and the Sunnis who still support the Alawite regime. You also have to keep in mind that our allies in the Gulf, the Saudis and the Qataris, are supporting these people with money at a private level. You know, the Saudis are also have intelligence people that are sending arms across. So whether we like it or not, we've, in their minds, in the Alawites' minds, we've been drawn into this civil war. And it's not getting any better. You know, they can give up the sarin, and I wonder if they'll give it all up. But at the end of the day, this isn't going to end the war.
And on Sunday, the Syrian National Council rejected the Geneva peace talks. They're not going to show up. And that's, of course, the largest umbrella group for the opposition, led by George Sabra. So that doesn't bode well. So there you have the irony, I guess. You know, we're all celebrating getting rid of the chemical weapons. Meanwhile, the killing fields are alive and well.
And it's going to spread. You know, I can't tell you when, but this, again, is going to draw Lebanon in, Jordan. The refugees are just getting worse, more pouring into Jordan. How long they can last is anybody's guess. You know, we at the end of the day, I hate to say this because it's so repugnant to the political class in this country, but we have to sit down with the Iranians, the Turks, the Saudis and the Qataris at the same table. We have to find a way out of this. We've got to stop sending arms into Syria and find a way to disarm people and draw lines between the two groups. I can't say, you know, a democratic election is not going to work for decades. But somewhere we got to draw the line. There's absolutely no benefit, anybody's benefit, to destroy Syria as a country, including Israel's.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, as well as the former Soviet Union. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Story. So the New York Times is, on Thursday carried a story that indicated that Edward Snowden was flagged by his supervisors for trying to break into classified computer files, which he wasn't authorized to do, and they decided to send him home, but they didn't tell the NSA about this and about their concerns about Snowden's distinct change in his behavior, his work habits, as well as troubling suspicions from the attempt to break into these files. What I find extraordinary about this, Robert Baer, is the following day in the New York Times, the CIA disputed a lot of the story, but they didn't refute it. I mean, they denied it, but didn't refute it. And the basic points of the story, they didn't refute. So I'm confused. What do you make of it?
Well, if the CIA, it's a practice of theirs with the journalists that cover intelligence. If a journalist has the story completely wrong, they will say it. You got the story wrong. You know, we will deny it outright. Say just this isn't true. So there's some parts of that story that are true. The chances, look, why would Snowden care to get into databases that he wasn't allowed in Geneva? I mean, nothing goes on in Geneva. There's, you know, a case here and there, but you know, to get in Directorate of Operations databases in Geneva, there's no interest to, you know, you or me. Just, there's nothing goes on there of any importance. So was he directed to do this? And any competent counterintelligence officer would look at this and say, hey, did the Russians get in touch with him in Geneva? Did they tell him to get into these databases? Did they direct him to go to the National Security Agency? I mean, when I say this, is in no means do I agree with NSA snooping on common citizens, but I'm just saying, from a suspicious point of view, you really do have to wonder.
Well, I've wondered about, I mean, I'm just trying to processing what you're saying here, but I have wondered, there's a lot of information that makes one a little bit suspicious that this whole thing could be a very clever and rather textbook Russian intelligence operation where, you know, Putin just took us to the cleaners and he's obviously enjoying himself. And we, you know, our side just look like idiots. I mean, if you put together the idea that Russian reports have indicated that Snowden was staying in the Russian consulate in Hong Kong all along when he was there, the first thing that they leaked came out on the very eve of Obama's meeting with Xi Jinping, the new leader of China, out here in Palm Springs. That leak was incredibly damaging to Obama. It was a presidential finding where he had signed an order to target China for cyber warfare when, in fact, the build-up to the first meeting with the new Chinese president was that Obama was going to go to town on this guy about Chinese spying on the United States and cyber attacks, etc. So that completely undercut Obama, and I felt at the time that there's a political motive behind this. This is not a bunch of anarchists like WikiLeaks running amok.
No, this is too smart. It's got all the hallmarks of an intelligence operation. You know, it really does. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, nothing that Snowden has put out really has gotten into the real nitty-gritty of intercepts and diplomatic code breaking and things like that. What did he have access on that? That's the kind of thing that a state like China or Russia would keep to itself and not even acknowledge that Snowden, you know, exposed those secrets to the Russians or the Chinese, if in fact he did. So, you know, the more you see of this, the more you have to wonder. And he didn't go to Russia without the green light of the KGB. Or in this case, the FSB. He arrives at the airport. They immediately take this into hand. They just don't, you know, they control all security in the country. So it's just naive to think that he was sitting in the transit lounge waiting for his, you know, something to be decided. It's just silly to even think that. The Russians had already approved this the moment he set foot on the plane from Hong Kong to Moscow. So, you know, it's going to take a while to sort this out, but, you know, I totally agree with you that, you know, you really have to be looking at this as a directed, covert action operation by the Russians, and it's worked beautifully.
And the second leak came on the eve of the G8 summit in Ireland recently, and that played right into Putin's hands because, you know, remember Obama referred to Putin as scowling in the corner like a schoolboy because the leak indicated that British intelligence GCHQ had monitored an earlier G20 meeting in London, and Putin made a big deal out of how can we talk to you guys when you monitor us, you know. So there again, it felt like that leak was also politically orchestrated. And then you have to add to that the fact that when the Bolivian president's plane was grounded and they were, you know, absolutely indignant, and all the Latin American leaders were very indignant about it, my understanding is that leak that Snowden was on the Bolivian president's plane came from the Russians. So that ended up making the U.S. look bad. Is that your understanding?
They're running circles around us. You know, we gave up doing this classic intelligence. And can you imagine what damage this has done between the United States and Britain? GCHQ is a fairly competent organization. And here we are hiring, you know, low-cost contractors that aren't being vetted because big corporations are doing the vetting, and they're spilling all our secrets. The crown jewels are out there. So, you know, if I were GCHQ, I would stop talking to the National Security Agency, you know, de-Americanize intelligence. You really have to, you know, this whole Reaganomics of outsourcing national security has been a clear catastrophe, and nobody is raising the flag. We've got to do something about this.
So what's your sense then of I mean, if this was an intelligence operation, and it certainly has all the hallmarks of one, and Putin, after all, is the head of state and a former intelligence operative, and there's a very good book by Russian scholar at Brookings, Fiona Hill, Mr. Putin, operative in the Kremlin, and it explains that he really operates as an intelligence officer, not as a head of state.
He loves this stuff. He was an awful intelligence officer. He never did anything in East Berlin.
Right.
His file, we acquired it. He was just an awful intelligence. He's a wannabe.
Right.
So for some smart KGB officer to put this operation together, he's got to love it.
Right.
And he thinks that the world is driven by intelligence, and all his former KGB colleagues just sort of run the Kremlin.
Right.
You know, of some, you know, so, you know, he lives in a different world.
But if they recruited Snowden back in 2009 when he was in Geneva, and he managed to then move to the NSA, which is where the real intelligence is, and then he was able to cherry-pick, apparently, an awful lot of stuff. Nobody quite knows how much of the cash that he got. But it looks as though, if you follow the logic of this, that he was able to go to the NSA and bide his time, get into all their systems, get a huge cache of it, and then have this exfiltration that's covered by Glenn Greenwald and WikiLeaks to make it look like they're the ones involved in this whole thing, to cover up the fact that this is an exfiltration back to Russia, as, you know, a perfect way to get their guy out. I mean, if that's...
Yeah, well, what is Greenwald and WikiLeaks know what goes through this guy's head? I mean, they're useful idiots in all of this. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. They're just useful idiots, you know? And it's worked perfectly. It's a nasty world out there, and the Chinese and the Russians do better at it than we do. And we just have to face that. We just sort of gave up intelligence after the Cold War.
Well, it looks like if this is true, Putin's having a ball, because RT, the Russian English language, Putin's English language propaganda channel, they're showcasing a group of Americans, many of whom I know quite well. I had Thomas Drake just recently out here at the UCLA Hemmer Forum, and they're meeting, the whistleblowers are meeting with Snowden in Moscow now, and it's all been over RT. So, you know, the impression you get, if this is all true, that this is an intelligence operation, is that they're continually tweaking us. If our side know how much they've been had, I imagine this is rubbing salt in the wound.
You're going to see a lot more of this. I think there was an organized program at the National Security Agency to intercept commercial communications and give them to U.S. corporations to declassify them. Can't prove that, but, you know, once that starts, you know, it's a catastrophe. It's like the sinking of the Titanic.
So this is you're saying that irrespective of whether or not this Snowden thing was a very clever Russian operation, that the NSA have basically sold out to corporate America?
Yeah. It bought off on outsourcing all of its technology, and then turning around and handing, you know, various secrets to the American corporations.
So, you know, that was the reason when Bill Casey was being considered for the CIA job, that he didn't even want to put his holdings into a blind trust. But that was the whole issue there, that you can't mix intelligence with business, because if you get, you know, you have an enormous advantage if you control an intelligence agency of getting extraordinary intelligence and being incredibly valuable and have great commercial value. And there was a wall built between the intelligence services and corporate America. And you're saying that the wall's come down.
It's completely come down. In fact, it is corporate America. You've got contractors at the National Security Agency and the CIA hiring more contractors. It's all about money. It's not about national security. And that's across the board. So it's a place to put your dip net in and make a lot of money if you're in Washington. That's why the property market there, one reason, and the Pentagon is just ballooned. It never went down in 2008 because so much money is to be made. If you and I want to get rich, go to Washington, sell a contract, Pentagon or the CIA, and it's, you know, instant wealth.
So it's now being driven by money. All this idea of patriotism and defending America, that's secondary.
Absolutely secondary. It's about money. It's about money. And there are still people there doing a fantastic job, but they sort of ignore it, the rest of the world, you know. They know what's going on. They just try to do the best job they can. I'm not talking about the whole intelligence community. I'm just talking about, you know, 90% of the $80 billion that's spent on intelligence is being siphoned off into corporations. And the people doing the real work, and there are some, the people that caught Bin Laden, you know, are heroic, and they're getting paid every 2 weeks a modest salary. It's not to take it away from them. It's just the bulk of the intelligence community is wasted money.
Well, Rob Bear, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon, as well as the former Soviet Union. He's the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Story. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you.
So, Alan, let me ask you about the context of your book, White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and the extent to which now the American Conservative Movement has completely – they're dominating our press. They're dominating our government. The center is all but irrelevant and useless and futile. They keep calling for bipartisanship, and there's no such thing on the planet. The left are completely absent and irrelevant too. So here we are in a country essentially captured by the far right. So is this the zenith? Is this the apotheosis of the white Protestant nation, and it's all downhill from now?
I think that's right. In my book, although it was finished in 2007, I predicted the internal explosion of the conservative movement and along with it the internal explosion of the Republican Party. That for a very, very long time, they were able to subsist by really concealing in many important ways what were their absolute core values, which included unconditional support for private enterprise, not free enterprise, but private enterprise, and unconditional support for what they saw as traditional white Protestant values, opposition to gays and lesbians, extreme anti-abortion and anti-pornography views. And that's exactly what we are seeing now, that the Republican Party has been captured by this far-right group that represents maybe 25% of the American people, and they are essentially driving the Republican Party into the ground, not because of anything that Democrats have done, but because of this internal implosion within the party. According to the most recent poll, the Republican Party's standing is at its lowest level since modern polling began, at 24%. And that's exactly what I predicted was going to happen, certainly one of the scenarios in white Protestant nation.
But do you think that memories are long enough in our political 24-hour news cycle by November of next year? Will people remember?
Well, Nate Silver, the pollster, says no, but he's a pollster. He doesn't understand the bigger dynamics of politics that I talked about in my book. He just goes by the minute-by-minute polls, and he says, you know, in 10 months from now, the polls will shift and this will be forgotten. I do not believe that is true. I think Republicans in these 20 or so swing districts, many of them won by President Obama, are going to be in deep trouble. This trauma has been going on long enough, so it's not going to be forgotten. Plus, there's a even bigger picture here. That is, the Republican Party, and particularly the Republican right, is fighting against, and I pointed this out in my book, the basic demography of the nation. The Republican base, hence the title of my book, The Conservative Base, is white and Protestant. And that is the most rapidly shrinking part of the American electorate. It's being surpassed not only by racial minorities, and by the way, it's not just Hispanics. The most rapidly rising minority is actually Asian Americans, who are also put off by Republican policies, and maybe even rising faster than that is those who profess no religious affiliation at all, and that's particularly rising rapidly among young people. So their future is very much in doubt based on the brass tacks of demography. So what we're seeing now is the Republican right trying to do everything it can while it still holds on to a modicum of power. And if you look at the bigger picture, it's not just what's going on in Washington. It's what's going on in the individual states. States passing ruthless voter suppression laws. States passing highly restrictive and many believe unconstitutional anti-abortion laws. And 26 states dominated by Republicans, including, I think, virtually every state in the South, opting out of the Medicaid expansion part of the Affordable Care Act, leaving millions of near-poor people vulnerable, falling into the gap between the expansion of Medicare and the individual mandate. So they're trying to do everything they can while they still hold on to some modicum of power, but they are fighting something that nobody can win against, and that's demography.
So, again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at the American University who studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. So, Alan, what do you make of Congressman Paul Ryan trying to get in on the act? He apparently upset his conservative base in a Wall Street op-ed by not mentioning Obamacare. He met on Saturday with the House members, and they've come up with this plan to solve two fiscal crises, all of which have been generated by and created by the House Republicans. He wants to remove the family planning coverage of Obamacare and then delay its defunding. He's not going to give up on killing it, but he also wants to take it, redo the entire tax structure, offset the sequester cuts on defense spending by going after Medicare. Is this just grandstanding?
Well, it's partly grandstanding. Paul Ryan is smart, he's young, and he's very ambitious. And he sees this as an opportunity to try to vault him into contention for the Republican presidential nomination of 2016, which is not looking right now like a very bright prospect for anyone. But I think Ryan understands that there is an opportunity for a young, smart guy like him to position himself somewhere between the old line Republicans and the extremists on the far right. But it's not going anywhere. The truth is, the president cannot make any significant concessions on the Affordable Care Act. It's not going to happen, because if he does that, then indeed every single time that a debt ceiling or a government funding comes up, the right wing is going to use this to try to extract further concessions. This will become, as so often happens in Washington, what was once unthinkable will become routine. You know, the remarkable thing here is, you know, the Heritage Foundation under former Senator Jim DeMint is really, some say he's really the shadow speaker of the House, really the leader of this Republican charge, and that Boehner is pretty much out of control. This plan, which it's not government taking over health, far and away not. All the insurance companies are still in business. It's simply requiring people under a mandate to purchase health care, many with assistance from the government. And if they don't do it, they face a modest fine. This was a Heritage Foundation proposal, an alternative to the liberal single-payer plans or even a government exchange for insurance. It was adopted by the Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney when he was governor of Massachusetts, and now they're calling it communism and socialism and saying it's going to destroy the country. As an historian, Ian, I can tell you, we've heard this line from the right every single time the government passes a major piece of legislation that helps people. We heard this after Social Security. We heard this after the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We heard this after Medicare and Medicaid. We heard this after Americans with Disability Act back in the 90s. And none of these pieces of legislation, of course, destroyed the economy. They all strengthened the economy and made us a fairer, stronger, better, and more equal country. So all of this screaming and yelling about destroying the country is an old, old, and discredited line, and the American people aren't buying it. You know, they're pushing against public opinion, and they're dividing their own party. And that's not a strategy either to win this battle or to maintain the future health of the party. Every time this has been done, it's been a disaster. It was a disaster for Newt Gingrich in 1995, 1996. And frankly, the Democrats once made this mistake under the great Franklin Roosevelt, you know, the all-powerful in 1937, when he tried to push his court-packing plan through the Congress, divided his own party, and alienated the public. This strategy doesn't work.
Well, the one thing you forgot to add to that, Alan, is the fact that they are now in the process of destroying the government, and they're about to destroy the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. What they're saying is, you know, Obamacare is so dangerous, it's going to destroy the economy. We think so. But to make sure it doesn't do that, we are going to positively and assuredly and affirmatively destroy the economy. And remarkably, they're losing their business support. You know, pretty conservative organizations like the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers have urged them to stop this. Even the Koch brothers, get this, the Koch brothers have distanced themselves from this tactic because, you know, business, you know, what they care about is the bottom line. Yes, they have their ideological priorities, but their ultimate priority is profit. And, you know, they see this as hurting their bottom line, and they don't want it to continue. And the shrewd businessmen know. They know, if anything, Obamacare benefits business. It relieves them from certain responsibilities, and it's an enormous boon to the insurance companies. And ultimately, it does reduce the cost of health care, because it's a lot less expensive to have people insured than to have them seeking medical care outside the insurance system.
So do you think that the thing that worries me is that with all of this, you know, extortion, government by extortion, at some point or other, the word compromise, even though it's a dirty word on the Republican side, is the very word they're using now. Negotiate and compromise. the two things they decided not to do at Williamsburg in their meeting after their defeat in 2012 was not to negotiate, not to compromise. And now, around the clock, it's the echo chamber of the Republican, talking points just keep coming back to you in this mantra, negotiate and compromise. Unfortunately, the president has a tendency to preemptively compromise and sometimes give away the store before he's even got into negotiations. What's your sense of whether or not he's going to stick? You know, I mean, he really can't afford to give in, can he? I mean, to this kind of...
He can't afford to give in. He can make, you know, symbolic concessions on perhaps negotiations on the budget, but he can't give in on the affordable health care. That's the centerpiece of his administration. That's what people are going to remember most about the Obama years is the Affordable Care Act. It's the most important piece of federal social legislation since Americans with Disability Act in the early 1990s, and maybe the most important piece of social legislation since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society of the 1960s. He cannot give in to any major concessions on the Affordable Care Act. Maybe something around the far edges, but that's it. He can't scuttle his own legacy. And, you know, the remarkable thing here, too, is, the Tea Party Republicans, the conservatives, and this is also in my book, are always crying Constitution. You know, we can't do anything that isn't authorized under the Constitution. And here they are going ahead and acting in a way that has no sanction in the Constitution. I'm not saying they can't do it, but it certainly, you know, jars with their ideology of strict adherence to the Constitution. There is a constitutional way of repealing the Affordable Care Act. Win the House, win the Senate, and win the presidency, and repeal it. This is the law of the land. They're also always screaming law and order. This law was passed by both houses, signed by the president, and sanctioned by the Supreme Court.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Alan, just going back to your book, White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, so much of this is a combination of God and mammon. You know, they're basically, the Tea Party's become shills for the billionaires. We know that. But there's also this element of apocalyptic religion where you've got to tear the house down. You've got to, the end of times. Michelle Bachmann, by the way, just a couple of days ago on Right Wing Talk Radio, said that we are entering the end of times, and that she implied without saying that Obama was the Antichrist, but she said that what he's doing in Syria, what's happening now in Syria, is the beginning of the end of times, and by arming the rebels, Obama is bringing about, you know, the prophecy of Armageddon. So I can see the connection between Armageddon and the default on the debt. That all makes sense in that kind of mindset. So is this a combination of economic illiteracy and biblical prophecy?
No question. Biblical prophecy is very important. You know, that's why I entitled my book, White Protestant Nation, because this adherence to a very strict biblical, in some cases almost theocratical, view of politics is always been, since, you know, I began my book a century ago, it goes back to the end of World War One. It's always been a critical element of conservatism. It's in many ways the driving emotional force, even more important than the business side, because it's what fires up the grassroots. And, you know, when the Tea Party first came around, a lot of people were saying, oh, all they care about is limited government. And I kept saying, no, that's not what they care about. They care deeply about these social, religious issues. That's at their core, and that has certainly been proven absolutely right. The other thing is, this is very important, this has nothing to do with limited government. Conservatives do not stand for limited government. It's one of the big messages of my book. Conservatives simply stand for a different form of big government than liberal big government. Who is the biggest spender as a president in history, and the biggest bureaucracy builder? It's George W. Bush, far and away. What conservatives really stand for is a government where the emphasis is on military action, defense spending, police forces, border security, police in the bedroom to make sure that you don't engage in homosexual acts or engage in abortion, or even in some cases, contraception. If they had their way, our government would be even bigger and more repressive than it is today.
Well, Alan Glickman, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Take care, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Glickman, a professor of history at American University who studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He is a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, a contributing editor for The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
These two crises that we have, both self-inflicted wounds generated by the far right of the Republican Party, the shutdown of the government and the looming possibility of a default. What is your understanding, given now that the Koch brothers have sent a letter to the senators saying we're not responsible for the activities of the Tea Party? We know that they're meeting in the Senate. We also know that on Saturday, Paul Ryan met with the House and urged them not to go along with Senator Susan Collins' compromise. He's offering up his own idea of reforming the tax code, getting rid of family planning in Obamacare, and delaying the defunding but not ending the killing of it, and that way stopping the default. What's your sense of all of these players trying to get in on the act?
Well, I think at this point, Ryan is simply grandstanding. It's basically, hey, I'm over here, look at me. I mean, I don't think he's actually a serious player in this at this point. It's pretty clear. It was done a couple of days ago. You're right that the Koch brothers said they sort of washed their hands of default, really, I think. So did a lot of other donors. It's plain that in the last week, a lot of donors to Tea Party or other far-right groups just said, okay, we're not going to mess with the standard of value, i.e. the U.S. dollar, which would certainly take a huge plunge if the U.S. actually defaults, plus a sort of unknowable other large amount of catastrophe. And that's the big change, I think, in the Republican Party. It's not 2 or 3 points in the polls that people are saying, well, or even 10 points in the polls. This is not what's driving these folks to suddenly, it's the change in their funders. I think that's absolutely plain. I think it was kicked off in public, actually, by that guy that runs Heritage Action. When he first said, he was not going to go to default, and then almost in the same breath alluded to the fact that the Kochs had given him, I forget, $500 million or so. Same interview. It was at the Christian Science Monitor, though it was published in the Huffington
right.
Post.
Was that Jim DeMint? Because
No, it was not DeMint. It's the younger guy profiled yesterday in, I think his name is Meeker. Might be wrong on that one. No, it's not DeMint. He runs the whole Heritage. This is Heritage Action, which is the political arm. So what's happening is that the Republican Party really is splintering here. And I'll be surprised if they can collect 80 votes among the Republicans against some kind of resolution to avoid debt default. I'll bet it'll be smaller, though it won't be zero. And it's perfectly obvious, though, in the last few days, the Senate Republicans were telling the House, except, for, of course, for Ted Cruz. And he was becoming a little mealy-mouthed, if you paid close attention, that they would pass something if the House wouldn't. And they were thus setting up a dynamic where, again, the Senate Dems, the Republicans, compromise. Then they send a proposal to the House, and then one way or the other, it comes through, probably with Democratic votes and Republican votes. And you know, that looks to me on the trajectory where we're headed. Something could glitch. I'd be the, you know, can't. There, when it's over, it's over. But that looks to me where we're at. Ryan's stuff is just piling on conditions that nobody's really interested in. The serious bill's going to be Reid and McConnell. And, you know, it'll be something of a cross between what the Democrats want and probably what's in the Collins bill, though there is a plan by Portman that was floating around, too. I mean, there's a lot of plans floating around at this point. And, you know, watch McConnell and Reid, though. McConnell's running for re-election against a Tea Party opponent, so I assume he will grandstand himself a bit Monday or Tuesday. You may have, in other words, a kind of Perils of Pauline approach to this. But my bet would be Reid and McConnell produce something. It passes the Senate. Then it goes to the House. Then Boehner finally, you know, he'll either allow a vote or they'll find one way or another a vote will happen. I mean, discharge petitions can spring a vote, but that would be that's sort of like a real slap on the face to the Speaker. I assume at that point he'd bring it to the floor rather than face a discharge petition. And so, you know, probably this ends. Now, all it does is, in all probability, kick the can down the road. It's obvious that another deadline is going to be mid-January, because then a whole new series of budget cuts will kick in. And much of the interest this week will be whether the Democrats can negotiate out some of those cuts in this bill, or all they do is agree to sort of temper, get the debt limit suspended, and maybe the government reopens so they can all go around the mulberry bush again.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He is a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation and author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. So we've spoken before, Tom, where you made the point that all of the talk about deficits is just a stalking horse, a smokescreen for the real agenda of the Republicans, which is to cut the taxes on the rich.
That's right.
And
this has become the dominating fact of American politics, and you know, one may add, of the media. I am struck. I was watching Chris Hayes the other night, and he did not want to talk about that when one of his panelists brought that up. You know, Hayes is supposed to be the progressive host of a talk show. Why doesn't he want to talk about this? Would be, you know, one question I'd have. If you look at the history of Jeff Bezos, who just bought the Washington Post, you will see that he's something of a stout anti-tax champion. And I don't doubt that you'll soon be seeing more of this in the Washington Post. There, not that they haven't already done plenty on this, but the anti-taxation, and really, I mean, look, these people are not looking out for small bracket folks; they're looking for the top bracket folks. Is absolutely the preoccupation of just an enormous chunk of the Republican Party, and also, I may add, of a lot of Democrats.
Well, how do they do it, though, with the deficit coming down? I mean, at the bottom, much of what they're talking about in terms of shutting down the government and even defaulting, particularly the Tea Party people and their constituents who are backing them up, it almost has a kind of an apocalyptic religious overturn to it, the idea that we need to, you know, the government is just so broken, we need to purge it, we need to renew it, we need the to tear the house down, the temple down, to get
the
born
insanity,
again.
Insanity, of course.
But it's based upon this idea that we are so desperately in debt, and that they believe in their economic illiteracy that raising the debt ceiling is the same as increasing our debt, which it's not.
Yeah, right.
So that's the problem, isn't it? This whole idea, how do they sell this idea that the sky is falling because of the budgets, because of the deficits, when the deficits are going down?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the first point to make, is that with this very slow, agonizingly slow recovery we've had, at least until the shutdown, the deficit position's improved a lot over the next few years. It doesn't, I mean, from their standpoint, that is the folks that want to cut spending, they see a rise in Social Security and medical spare coming, although the Social Security rise is just, it's almost nothing even on their own numbers. It's really, it's actually perverse how much they sort of want to do that. But it's just not enough. I mean, look, all you hear about conversations with some of these folks is the need to get taxes down. And yeah, you're right. It's a litany. It's a religious experience. But you know, fundamentally, it's not about anything other than that. So how do they do it? Well, they rely on the fact that most people don't have any clear idea of the difference between a single household's budget and the national economy and the role the government budget plays in that. I mean, put simply, they don't get, for example, that if everybody tries to save, including the government, meaning not spend anything all at once, they'll crash the economy. Really, this is when you say, I mean, I'm very friendly to Dean Baker's observation when he says that, you know, when you say that the public is confused, what you mean is the media is not presenting anything like the full state of affairs. In the United States, it's hard to find any television show host willing to talk about the government spending and the deficits in a sensible way. I mean, even the so-called progressives tend to want to think somehow that cutting the budget is really a good idea. It comes to that. There's not a whole lot more, nothing too terribly complicated here. You have that famous case some years back where Ryan was taken out by a couple of big investors and they were buying, I forget, $600-$800 bottle of wine. It was written up in the Huffington Post. That's life in the 1% right now. You sit there, sip expensive wines, and talk about how you can cut Social Security and Medicare.
And do you think then that is what's going to happen at the end of the day, that this drastic tactic on the part of the Republicans will eventually pay off?
They're actually doing, which was for all but a few fanatics, the Obamacare business is really kind of a stalking horse. What the sort of main investors in the party want is a big cut in the budget across the board, not just Obamacare. And anybody could see how the mainstream of the Republican Party was happy to throw the sort of single-minded focus on Obamacare, not that they like it, under the bus in favor of a broader budget discussion. And in the plans that are semi-rational coming out of the Republicans, you can see very plainly they are building on some of the proposals the president himself advanced in previous budget discussions. Those involve trimming Medicare, sometimes what they say it means testing it, and usually the so-called chain CPI, which is a de facto reduction of Social Security. So, yeah, I think the White House has been signaling for years that it would really like to do some cuts on Medicare and Social Security. The difficulty is they couldn't find anybody in the Republican Party who would say yes to the cuts they were willing to make. And, you know, they might finally in the end get together. I would have some anxiety about the outcome of any budget procedure they're going to enter into, and it is perfectly obvious that another round of bigger budget talks lies ahead of us. I don't assume those will all be concluded in a week. I mean, you're going to end up kicking the can down the road, and the only question is how long you kick it, how far you kick it.
Yeah, but you have to make a compromise in order to have the can kicked. Otherwise, the whole damn house comes down on October 17th. I mean,
yes. I mean, but they're not. I don't think anybody's going to try to do a deal, say, on Social Security and Medicare in the next week. I don't see it.
Well,
what
that's
they'll do
what?
Is they'll enter into budget talks, probably with some advance understandings about the limits of everybody's position.
Right. Well, that's, of course, what Ryan wants, and he doesn't want the Susan Collins deal to go through because he wants to make changes in Medicare to offset cuts to domestic spending and defense programs. That's the sequester. In other words, undo the sequester on defense and throw it all onto Medicare, delay Obamacare and cut out the family planning provision.
Look, it's the Christmas tree of everybody's provisions on the far right, with the exception that Ryan is soft-pedaling Obamacare.
Right. Well, he got slammed because of that op-ed he wrote in the Wall
right.
Street Journal, the way he didn't mention it. And now he had to go and speak to his colleagues on Saturday in the Congress and say...
Yeah, that was the whole trick. That's why Ryan suddenly gets attention. Because it's now viewed as a potentially bargainable situation. I mean, that's his claim to being not dismissed as a complete crank, which is the fate of all the folks fixated on Obamacare.
Well, Jay Carney, the president's press secretary, said that Obama appreciates the constructive nature of the conversations and the proposal that House Republicans put forward. Although he has some concerns about it. Boy, I have...
Yep. No. When you see the White House talking like that, you got to pay attention.
Meaning that you got to call
him
up.
This is clearly a problem. I mean, we've been over this ground before, Ian, but there is just no basis for cutting Social Security. I mean, just none. And it's just grotesque to even think about it, given what's happened to everybody's pensions. And the way so many unemployed people of higher ages cannot find work. I mean, it's just disgraceful. I mean, I will not, however, be a broken record here.
Okay. Well, on that note, Thomas Ferguson, I thank you so much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He is a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, a contributing editor for The Nation, and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and our back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.